The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the February 20th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine. And we start with the main stories and how they were covered. Obama's request to step up the ISIS fight. What happened? Amid signs of progress in the war against ISIS, President Obama this week asked for Congress to formally approve the use of military force against the Islamic radicals in Syria and Iraq for 3 more years. In a carefully worded compromise designed to appease both hawks and doves, the resolution asks for a congressional authorization for a limited engagement with a prohibition on enduring offensive ground combat operations. Obama said his proposal would, however, authorize ground combat operations in limited circumstances, including rescue operations and special forces operations, to take military action against ISIL leadership. In his request, the president said ISIS poses a threat to the region and to U.S. national security, and he cited 4 American hostages killed by the group, including Kayla Mueller, an American aid worker whose death was confirmed last week. On the battlefield, U.S.-led airstrikes and ground assaults by Kurdish and Iraqi forces have dealt ISIS a series of defeats. Kurdish fighters recently retook the Syrian town of Kobani, and Iraqi government troops forced the Sunni extremist group out of Diyala province, northeast of Baghdad. Iraqi and Kurdish forces have also made significant gains in the strategically important Iraqi cities of Baiji and Samarra and cut off the main supply route to ISIS-held Mosul, which will be the focus of a major offensive in coming months. American officials believe 6,000 militants have been killed since airstrikes began in August, including half of ISIS's top commanders. In an interview this week, Secretary of State John Kerry said the U.S. was on the road to defeating ISIS. What the editorial said: ISIS is now learning that terrorism can turn with a vengeance against those who inflict it, said the New York Times. When the group released its gruesome video of a captured Jordanian pilot being immolated, the Middle East erupted in fury. Jordan unleashed dozens of airstrikes on ISIS positions in Syria, and the United Arab Emirates launched its first air attacks since December. ISIS now faces potent censure and opposition from people across the region. ISIS is definitely hurting, said The Economist. Airstrikes have destroyed many of the group's captured oil installations, reducing its oil revenue from $2.4 million a day last June to $750,000 today. And ISIS's aura of invincibility has been punctured by its defeat in Kobani, where 1,000 militants were killed. Still, new foreign fighters are joining its ranks, and unless the U.S. and its allies can decide what to do about the chaos in Syria, ISIS will at most be contained. What the columnist said: inside ISIS, cracks are developing, said Jamie Detmer in thedailybeast.com. Sources in Syria say there have been sharp divisions among militants over what to do with hostages, and hundreds of fighters have been executed for desertion. The group is also splitting into factions. Gulf Arabs envy the power of the Iraqis, who form the core of the leadership, while North African recruits complain they are being treated as cannon fodder and receiving none of the spoils of war. Clearly, ISIS has miscalculated, said Aaron David Miller in the Los Angeles Times. But will the widespread revulsion of its savagery lead to more effective and concerted action by its neighboring Arab states? Unlikely. Having seen what ISIS does to prisoners of war, the rulers of Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates will be even less inclined to deploy the ground troops so desperately needed. Ultimately, it'll have to be the Iraqi army that leads the fight, said Kenneth Pollack in the New York Times. U.S. officials believe a smaller, retrained Iraqi force will be ready to launch a huge offensive this year. But political progress has not kept pace with the military campaign. Iraq's army is still overwhelmingly Shiite, and most of its recent successes have been spearheaded by Shiite militias. If these same militias also lead the drive into Sunni heartlands, the Sunnis will see them as a conquering Shiite army, and Iraq will again descend into civil war. To defeat ISIS, the U.S. must press for true political reconciliation between Iraq's Shiites and Sunnis, a difficult but hardly impossible task. Our controversy of the week, Obama, comparing ISIS's atrocities to the Crusades. You have to wonder sometimes if President Obama even believes the shallow, condescending nonsense that comes out of his mouth, said Michael Austin in NationalReview.com, or if he just says things to send conservatives into a tizzy. At the National Prayer Breakfast last week, just days after the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria burned a captured Jordanian pilot alive, our scold-in-chief decided this was just the moment to lecture Christians on the sins of their own religion. "Lest we get on our high horse," said Obama, who seldom dismounts from his own, "we should remember that during the Crusades and the Inquisition, people committed terrible deeds in the name of Christ." He then added that slavery and Jim Crow all too often was justified in the name of Christ. Obama's simplistic history lesson was true enough, said Peter Wenner in CommentaryMagazine.com. But he failed to add that the people who fought and overthrew slavery and segregation were also motivated by deep Christian belief. And if Obama were sincere about engaging in religious self-criticism, he need not go back 1,000 years. He could have apologized for happily sitting on the pews for years at his own pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, spewed racist conspiracy theories, and justified the 9/11 terrorist attacks as Americans' chickens coming home to roost. "Slavery and Jim Crow do not go back 1,000 years," says Ta-Nehisi Coates in TheAtlantic.com. In 1861, Confederate Vice President Alexander Stevens justified the war over slavery by explaining that God had designed black people as inferior and fit only for subordination. The Confederacy, Stevens said, was a nation founded in conformity with the ordinance of the Creator. About 750,000 Americans were slaughtered because Southerners clung so insistently to that belief. And for more than a century afterward, segregationists continued to rely on the Bible to justify racism, lynchings, and ISIS-like savagery. In his Segregation Now speech in 1963, Alabama Governor George Wallace invoked God 27 times and attacked federal plans for racial integration as the opposite of Christ. Does this mean that Christianity somehow caused slavery or segregation? Of course not. Obama's point was that Christians have used religion to sanctify their violence and their claim on power, just as the Muslim terrorists and ISIS are seeking to do today. But there's a glaring double standard in Obama's historical comparison, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. He is comfortable blaming Christianity for slavery, the Crusades, and the Inquisition, but he still insists that the butchers of ISIS are not Islamic. How is it that the sins of Christianity are eternal, but the sins of Muslim fanatics right now aren't even Muslim? You could ask George W. Bush the same question, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. Bush, like Obama, never missed an opportunity to draw a distinction between the peace-loving, true faith of Islam and the nihilistic violence perpetrated in its name. Why? Because that rhetorical strategy is vital to our success in the war on terrorism. The leaders of the self-styled Islamic State want to be portrayed as true Muslims fighting the Crusaders. If Obama were to say that Islam itself belongs in a special category of menace, he would alienate all 1.6 billion Muslims. And we desperately need moderate Muslims as allies. Obama may have gone about it clumsily, but he's right to frame the war we are fighting as peaceful people versus the terrorist, not as Western civilization versus Islam. Well, it was a good week for product placement. After Danielle Lai, an enterprising San Francisco Girl Scout, set up a stand outside a local marijuana dispensary and set a national record by selling 208 boxes of cookies in just 2 hours. It was a good week for Fair Warning after officials in Coney Township, Pennsylvania, erected welcome signs at the city line, alerting would-be criminals that the township is not a gun-free zone. A town official explained, "Even those who have bad intentions can read." And it was a good week for heartfelt performances. After a Colorado woman, pleading to be excused from jury duty, was told to come back to court the next day, she fell to her knees and began pulling out clumps of her own hair and was immediately excused. But it was a bad week for tough love after a Missouri couple was arrested for allegedly arranging to have their 6-year-old kidnapped because he was too nice to people. The boy was lured into a pickup truck, threatened with a gun and tied up, and then lectured about stranger danger. It was a bad week for first impressions after a Texas woman lost her prospective pizza delivery job because she tweeted, "Ooh, I start this blank job tomorrow." Her boss tweeted back, "No, you don't start that job today. I just fired you." And it was a bad week for waste management after a $110,000 a year water manager in San Francisco was suspended for urinating in a city reservoir, suspended without pay for 5 days, and warned that if he pees in the wrong place again, you are toast. On the briefing page this week, ruining the oceans. The world's seas are sick, and marine life is dwindling. Is it too late to avert catastrophe? Why are the oceans in trouble? They can no longer absorb the damage inflicted by the 7 billion people on Earth. Over many decades, the human race has overfished key species to near extinction and polluted them with carbon dioxide emissions, toxic chemicals, garbage, and discarded plastics. A groundbreaking new study recently published in Science warned that our oceans are being irreparably damaged by human activity and could be on the precipice of a major extinction event. Coral reefs, home to a quarter of the ocean's fish, have declined by 40% worldwide. Stocks of swordfish, yellowfin tuna, and other large fish that people avidly eat are down by 90%. Marine scientists say that if mankind does not dramatically change how it treats the oceans and their inhabitants, many marine species will become extinct, with catastrophic consequences for the food chain. If by the end of the century we're not off the business-as-usual curve, said Stanford University marine ecologist Stephen Palumbi, one of the report's authors, there's not much hope for normal ecosystems in the ocean. How does global warming affect fish? As the oceans heat up, many species are migrating to cooler waters to survive. Some inevitably will fail in these new habitats. Warmer temperatures also make coral reefs more vulnerable to bleaching, a chemical process that drains the organisms of their brilliant colors and leads to their death. Other problems are caused directly by the burning of fossil fuels. With oceans absorbing a quarter of the world's CO2 emissions, they have become 30% more acidic, causing inhibited shell growth in coral and crustaceans and reproductive disorders in fish. Power plant emissions, especially from burning coal, put tons of highly toxic mercury in the air, which settles into the ocean. The mercury is taken up by sea creatures and concentrated in predatory species. A recent study found that mercury levels in Pacific yellowfin tuna have been rising at a rate of 3.8% a year since 1998. If it keeps going like that, said co-author Carl Lamborg, eventually almost every kind of fish is going to be potentially hazardous. What about plastic? Our oceans contain an estimated 5.2 trillion pieces of plastic, most of them less than 5 millimeters wide, weighing a total of 269,000 tons. A lot of this detritus, which mostly comes from plastic bottles and discarded commercial fishing gear, has collected in the vast systems of rotating ocean currents known as gyres. The largest such collection, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, covers an area twice the size of Texas. The mostly tiny pieces of plastic in this and other patches contain many potentially hazardous chemicals and are being eaten by fish and birds that mistake them for plankton or small fish. As smaller animals are eaten in turn by predatory fish, the plastic becomes more concentrated and winds up in people who eat seafood. Can't we remove all the plastics? No chance. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration estimates that to clean less than 1% of the North Pacific, it would take 68 ships working 10-hour days a whole year. A skimming operation of that scope would also suck up tons of marine creatures. And with global plastic production doubling every 10 years, there's no way to keep up, said Chris Wilcox of Australia's National Science Agency. It would be as if you were vacuuming your living room and I'm standing at the doorway with a bag of dust and a fan. How big a problem is overfishing? Since fishing became industrialized just over a century ago, most commercial species have been reduced by more than 75% and some by 99%. As stocks dwindle, fishing fleets are increasingly resorting to bottom trawling, a hugely destructive technique that involves dragging a large net up to 60 meters wide along the seabed, scooping up everything in its path. Most countries now have fishing quotas, but they're hard to enforce. An estimated 1 in 5 fish sold in a shop or served in a restaurant has been caught illegally. Why aren't we doing more? Like global warming, the plight of our oceans is an issue that affects every country in the world. But with each government beholden to its own voters and its own fishing, plastic, and energy lobbies, it's almost impossible to achieve any consensus. Ecologists insist it's not too late to solve the problems affecting our oceans. Some schemes, such as the introduction of safe zones where fish can naturally replenish, have worked on a small scale and could be expanded. The authors of the science study say it's possible to reverse the current crisis, but political will is required. The next several decades, they say, will be those in which we choose the fate of the future of marine wildlife. The dangers of a fishy diet. For decades, doctors and health officials have encouraged people to eat as much seafood as possible because of fish's high levels of omega-3 fatty acids, which are good for heart and brain health. But in recent years, that recommendation has been tempered as emissions from factories and power plants have pushed mercury concentrations in the oceans and fish up to potentially dangerous levels. Mercury is highly toxic and can cause neurological damage and accumulate in the organs. In children and fetuses, it can lead to long-term cognitive disorders. Last year, the FDA updated its advice on fish to say that pregnant women and children should avoid eating tilefish, shark, swordfish, and king mackerel, and limit their consumption of white tuna, all of which contain particularly high levels of mercury because they're at the top of the food chain. Consumer Reports recently criticized the FDA guidelines on fish consumption as inadequate, saying that anyone who eats 24 ounces or more of fish per week, or about six servings, should steer clear of high mercury choices, and warning people not to eat canned tuna or sushi made from tuna. Turning to the columns now, the first from Jonathan Tobin at CommentaryMagazine.com. Why Paul won't be nominated. Rand Paul can't have the best of both worlds, said Jonathan Tobin. The U.S. Senator hopes to win the GOP's 2016 presidential nomination by putting together a coalition of libertarian activists allied with his firebrand father Ron and traditional Republicans unenthused about Jeb Bush and the other candidates. But as the brouhaha over Paul's anti-vaccination comments last week demonstrates, he becomes incoherent when trying to appeal to both camps. Paul first suggested that vaccination was linked to mental disorders, then had to backtrack, saying he personally believes in vaccination. Whenever Paul appeals to his libertarian base, he says something extreme he later retracts, or is stuck with a position that alienates most Republicans. This is particularly true of Paul's neo-isolationist foreign policy. Retreating from the Middle East might have been have had some appeal a year ago, but the rise of ISIS has jolted America into the realization that we cannot abandon our foreign responsibilities. Most Republicans want a presidential nominee who can rally the country to meet the challenge of radical Islam, not another President Obama. It's simply not possible for Paul to romance mainstream Republicans while keeping his libertarian credentials. From Kurt Anderson at the New York Times, the best decade of our lives. The 1990s were easily the happiest decade of our American lifetime, said Kurt Anderson. I am not a Clintonite. But when Republicans say that Hillary Clinton cannot run on 90s nostalgia, they may be fooling themselves. By almost every measure, that decade was special. The economy boomed, growing by an average of 4% a year from 1992 to 1999, as the unemployment rate sank to 4%, as low as it can possibly go. The federal budget went into surplus. Crime rates fell dramatically across the country. Overseas, South Africa dismantled apartheid, peace was restored to the former Yugoslavia, and Israel and the Palestinians agreed on a framework for peace in the Oslo Accords. In culture, Harry Potter novels thrilled young people, HBO inaugurated The Sopranos and began a new era of quality TV, and the internet boomed. But our devices had not yet taken over our lives, and we were blissfully ignorant of the first signs of climate change and the approach of 9/11. Nostalgia for that decade of progress, affluence, and peace is more than mere nostalgia. And from Russia, Michelle Birdie at the Moscow Times, misinformed about Western insults. It's no wonder Russians think the West is out to get them, said Michelle Birdie. Western leaders are routinely quoted in Russian newspapers with their words translated so as to amp up the hostility factor. Translation is just one more weapon in the propaganda wars, and the Russian press is wielding it without mercy. Most frequently, editors will distort a Western leader's message by cherry-picking phrases from a speech or report to make the whole thing sound aggressive, even if the bulk of the speech was friendly. Almost as often, Russian papers deliberately mistranslate for inflammatory effect. President Obama, for example, recently told Congress that Russia was isolated with its economy in tatters. Most Russian analysts reported that Obama said Russia had been torn to pieces. And one went further and claimed Obama said he's going to tear Russia apart like a dog rips apart a rubber toy. Sometimes they just make things up. Most Russians can quote verbatim a statement supposedly made by State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki that if Belarus attacks Ukraine, the U.S. Sixth Fleet will immediately land on its shores. Psaki, of course, said nothing even remotely like this about our landlocked ally. But to Russians, the message seems clear. America hates us. And our in-depth article this week, Vinyl Comes Full Circle. Vinyl records are enjoying an unexpected comeback, said John Harris, and pressing plants can't keep up. On an industrial estate in Rubel, 90 miles north of Berlin, the vinyl presses at the Optimal factory were grinding away. They made a percussive racket, regular clunks, wheezes, and hisses, underlaid by a droning hum, and created a distinct aroma, sharp and metallic, suggestive of steam engines and old cars. My guide for the day was Peter Rung, the 46-year-old operations director for the plant. He oversees the manufacture of DVDs, CDs, and books for Optimal. But the task in which he takes the most pleasure is supervising the production of vinyl records in what he and his colleagues claim is Europe's biggest pressing plant. Together, we watched copies of Nick Cave and Bad Seeds live from KCRW tumble from one of the machines. Across a narrow aisle, a press dedicated to 7-inch records was spitting out copies of The Boy from New York City, a 1964 single by the Ad Libs, a soul group from Bayonne, New Jersey. A few yards away sat fresh stock of Fleetwood Mac's Rumors. Next to those was a growing pile of the album Clandestine by the Swedish death metal band Entombed, being pressed on purple vinyl. Optimal's machines run 24 hours a day for most of the year, and production capacity has to be booked up to a year in advance. Every hiss and wheeze of the company's machines attests to that story. 20 or so years ago would have seemed unthinkable, the renaissance of the vinyl record. In the first half of 2014, officially registered sales of vinyl in the U.S. stood at around 4 million, an increase of more than 40% compared with the same period in 2013. That may represent a tiny fraction of the industry's estimated sales of recorded music, but still a means of listening to music essentially invented in the 19th century and long since presumed to be dead is growing at speed. Hanging over everything Runge showed me was an awkward question. While demand for records is increasing year by year, optimal stock of machinery is old and getting older. New presses are unaffordable unless the big companies were to invest, but vinyl is still too small a sector of the market for them to be convinced. The kind of painstaking maintenance and technical ingenuity one might think of as the Cadillacs in Cuba model keep the industry going. But for how long? When former music journalist Michael Hyentes started the independent German label Edel in 1986, he relied on other companies to press his records. They usually didn't get him the best delivery times, Rung said. So by the 90s, he said, I'll build my own plant. Thanks to economic policies aimed at assisting reunifications, Hyentes, who was from Hamburg, decided to locate his new factory on an industrial estate in Rübel, an unremarkable East German town in the Mecklenburg Lake District. Even when Optimal launched, it looked as though vinyl would soon become obsolete. Records had first been superseded by cassettes, which were portable but chronically unreliable. With the arrival of the compact disc in 1983, introduced to consumers with the lure of cleaner sound and the entirely specious promise of indestructibility, old-style records looked to be finished. In that context, Hyentes' decision to begin pressing records looked ludicrously sentimental. The company bought and installed its first vinyl presses in 1995 to service demand from independent companies producing dance music. DJs then still specialized in the art of playing and mixing 12-inch records. Most of the pressing machines Optimal acquired had come from decommissioned factories in the decade-long fire sale that followed the fall of the Soviet Union. In the late 1990s, six machines were used for production, while the rest were kept in storage for spares. At this point, after years of steady decline, the international market for new vinyl was plummeting. By 2001, the dance music world was increasingly embracing CDs, laptops, and MP3s. Rung began discussions with Optimal senior staff about whether they should leave records behind. There were a lot of meetings, he remembered. In 2007, Optimal was presented with the chance to buy 15 more Swedish presses from a company in East London that was facing liquidation. At the very least, they thought, some of the machines could be a much-needed source of spares. Rung made regular trips to the plant where he inspected what was on offer, not just presses, but also an archive of metallic master copies of stampers used to make the thousands of different records by artists including Simon and Garfunkel and the Manic Street Preachers, all of which could conceivably be put back into production. We bought everything, he told me. We emptied the building. The gamble was worth taking. During the 2000s, consumers had increasingly expressed a desire to hear music rendered as perfectly as possible. New vinyl-only labels had started to produce albums intended to capitalize on this interest and on rock music's built-in nostalgia. These were records you'd want to own, presented in luxuriant box sets, complete with hardback books and exact replica artwork. In 2008, vinyl was given its own annual celebration, Record Store Day, on the third Saturday in April, when record companies would create thousands of limited edition records coveted by collectors. Astute independent companies such as Rough Trade and Domino had also begun accompanying their records with exclusive download cards, so that anyone buying them could also access digital versions of the music, and thus, if they wished, not just put their new music on phones or iPods, but also keep their records pristine. By 2013, Optimal had 27 active presses manufacturing records around the clock. This year, with the addition of two machines that have been brought out of storage, The company says it will press 18 million records. In October 2010, on a Sunday evening, 14 people gathered in the wood-paneled upstairs room of the Hunbury Arms on Linton Street in Islington, North London. They had come to listen to a vinyl copy of Abbey Road, the Beatles' last album. The event was the first of a series called Classic Album Sundays, and the idea was simple enough. A small crowd would come together to spend a couple of hours eating, drinking, and talking before people took their seats, snapped into silence, and listened to both sides of an album played on hair-raisingly expensive equipment. The event was organized by an American named Colleen Murphy, who listened to the whole of Abbey Road lying on the floor. In early 2012, Classic Album Sundays was the subject of an item on the BBC Breakfast TV program. Ever since, most of Murphy's events have been sellouts, and they're now offshoots in Glasgow, Scotland, New York City, Oslo, and Portland, Maine. Murphy has lived in Britain since 1999. She DJs under the name Cosmo, produces and remixes music, and runs a vinyl-only label called Bitches Brew. At New York University, she became the program director of the renowned college radio station WNYU. And in the early 1990s, she began an enduring friendship with David Mancuso, who pioneered parties in Manhattan known as The Loft, where he played music through ambitious audio setups, only ever on vinyl. When Murphy first visited one of Mancuso's events, she told me, I couldn't believe how some of the records that I knew sounded so different. She decided to try the Loft idea in London. Early in December, I visited Murphy at her home in Hackney, East London. One downstairs room was lined with somewhere in the region of 10,000 records, arranged alphabetically by artist. After making tea, she jumped up and put on Jeff Buckley's Last Goodbye from his only completed album, Grace, released in 1994. Built around swirling guitar lines and Buckley's dizzying vocal, the song was transformed. The kick drum, which drives the song along but too often sounds buried in the mix, was suddenly at the heart of what I was hearing. Buckley's singing was so vivid as to evoke his physical presence. The sound that can trigger such an odd reaction is founded on a production process essentially unchanged in 70 years. First, the original music in the form of master tapes or digital files is cut into a lacquer of malleable plastic with a texture like that of nail varnish. This is the delicate stage of mastering, which Optimal carries out in a converted Catholic church in downtown Rubel. When Rung showed me around, three cutting lathes were carving the grooves for the jazz pianist Keith Jarrett's Sun Bear Concerts live album, the American indie rock band Warpaint's first album, The Fool, and a record by the San Francisco psychedelicists Quicksilver Messenger Service, which droned away in a corner. After mastering, the acetate disc is sprayed with atomized silver and dipped in chemicals, creating a metallic cast of the original disc known as the Father. Another metal disc, called the Mother, is cast from this one. The Mother is then used to create several mirror image suns or stampers, which are taken to the presses to imprint the grooves on heated vinyl. In the U.S., where there are only around a dozen pressing plants, the average waiting time between music arriving at a factory and a finished record's emerging used to be about 4 weeks. Now it runs to 3 months, which, in a world where musicians are used to snap releasing their material online, can create complications. At Optimal, record companies must book production as much as a year in advance. If the demand for vinyl continues to increase, what will happen when the orders begin to outstrip capacity? And what of the inevitable prospect of old presses reaching the limits of reconditioning and simply dying of old age? As far as anyone knows, the last new machines were created in the early 1980s. Presses now change hands for around $30,000, double what they cost 10 years ago. Sooner or later, companies such as Optimal will surely have to start thinking about fresh machinery. A new press would cost between 10 and 20 times as much as an old one, said Runge, and it has to pay off. If that took 30 years, no one would lend you the money, and that's the reason nobody's doing it right now. But if another 10 or 20 of our machines break down and are unrepairable, then we'll have no choice. Later that evening, near my hotel on Castagnale, the somewhat gentrified bohemian street that runs through the heart of Prenzlauer Berg, I went across the road to one of the city's scores of record music shops, Music Department. The shop was empty and about to close. The sole staff member on duty, a 41-year-old Falco Techman, an occasional DJ. We talked about the process of making records. I gushed about the impressive workmanship I had seen that day. "It's all worth it," Techman said simply. "It just sounds better, doesn't it?" This was from John Harris, Guardian News and Media Limited, excerpted from his original. In the obituaries this week, we actually have two with North Carolina sports connections, and we'll take a look at both of them. The first, the legendary coach who put his players first, Dean Smith, 1931 to 2015. As the head basketball coach at the University of North Carolina, Dean Smith mentored many of the great game's greatest players, including James Worthy, Billy Cunningham, and Michael Jordan. His teams won at least 20 games in 27 consecutive seasons, playing in 11 NCAA tournament Final Fours and winning two national championships. But despite his many accomplishments, Smith's humble team-first philosophy, known as the Carolina Way, always held sway, even when it came to his own achievements. "I don't think they should even keep coaching records," Smith wrote in his 1999 memoir, A Coach's Life. "The records belong to the players." Coach Smith had basketball bloodlines as deep and as blue as the Carolina sky, said USA Today. The son of school teachers, Smith grew up in Depression-era Kansas, earning an academic scholarship to the University of Kansas, where he played for Fog Allen, a protege of the game's inventor, James Naismith. In 1958, he went to work as an assistant to North Carolina coach Frank McGuire and took over the team 3 years later. After a series of mediocre campaigns, Tar Heel basketball found its footing under Smith in 1966, said the Los Angeles Times. He led the team to a 26-6 season that started a streak of three straight Final Four appearances. Smith had an equally big impact off the court, said the New York Times. Drawing on the moral code he was taught by his parents, Smith broke racial barriers in a changing South. Soon after arriving in Chapel Hill, he fought to desegregate one of the city's most popular restaurants. And in 1966, he made Charles Scott the first black scholarship athlete at North Carolina. Smith's commitment to social justice earned him an especially enduring stature, and in 2013 he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian award. But Smith rarely spoke about his role in the struggle for racial equality, which prompted one interviewer to ask him if he was proud of his civil rights record. "You should never be proud of doing the right thing," Smith replied. "You should just do the right thing." And the golfer who shattered racial barriers, Charlie Sifford, 1922 to 2015. Charlie Sifford was never cowed by the racism that he met on and off the golf course. The cigar-chomping golfer received so many death threats after becoming the PGA's first Black Tour member in 1960 that he played through North Carolina's 1961 Greater Greensboro Open with a police detail at his side. Sifford finished at the top of the leaderboard in the Open's first round, and that night received an anonymous phone call warning him not to show up the next day. His response was pure defiance. "Whatever you're going to do, you'd better be ready at 9:20 a.m., he told the caller, because that's when I'm going to be out there on the first tee. Working as a caddy at the Whites Only Country Club in Charlotte, North Carolina, Sifford was shooting par golf and smoking cigars by the time he was 13, said the Los Angeles Times. At 17, he was banned from playing at the club. The members were upset that he was better than them. Unable to join the PGA, which had a Caucasians-only rule, Sifford spent the 1950s playing on the less lucrative black golfers' circuit and competing in the few tournaments that accepted blacks and whites. The hostility Sifford encountered at those mixed events was ferocious, said the Washington Post. He faced death threats, heckling from spectators, and sabotage on the course. He often had to change in his car and eat lunch with the caddies because he wasn't allowed in the clubhouse. In 1960, after sustained pressure from civil rights groups and California's Attorney General, the PGA finally allowed black members, said the New York Times. Although his best playing days were behind him, the golfer showed what he might have accomplished in his prime, winning two tournaments on the PGA Tour and the PGA Seniors Championship in 1975. But his success was always tinged with regret. I really would like to know how good I could have been with a fair chance, he said. I had a gift, but I had too much pressure. I will never know. On the health and science page, heavy drinking linked to strokes. Men who average 3 drinks a day and women who average 2 face a significantly higher risk for stroke in middle age, a new study has found. The study by Swedish scientists examined drinking habits of more than 11,000 twins over 4 decades and found that those they defined as heavy drinkers in their 50s and 60s have a 34% higher risk for stroke than more moderate drinkers. That makes excessive alcohol consumption a greater risk factor in stroke than high blood pressure and diabetes. Heavy drinkers also were more likely to have strokes 5 years earlier than light drinkers, regardless of their genetics or other health habits. The findings are consistent with the American Heart Association's recommendation that men not exceed 2 drinks a day and women 1. Previous studies have found that moderate drinking can have a protective effect on heart disease and overall mortality, and the Swedish study found that abstaining from alcohol altogether did not lower the risk of stroke. Drinking is like Jekyll and Hyde, Tara Narula, a cardiologist at New York City's Lenox Hill Hospital, tells CBSNews.com. It can be medicinal and beneficial, or poisonous and detrimental, depending on how much you use. Slow and steady wins the race. Running too fast and too often may be just as unhealthy as not exercising at all, the Los Angeles Times reports. Researchers in Denmark studied a group of 5,000 people over a 12-year period and found that hardcore runners who routinely jogged at a brisk pace, a 7-minute mile or faster for 4 hours or more per week, were just as likely to die as those who did no exercise at all. Runners who jogged at a more leisurely pace, roughly a 12-minute mile for just over 2 hours per week, had significantly lower mortality rates. The findings are in keeping with a growing body of evidence that there is an ideal amount of exercise and that too much of a good thing can stress the cardiovascular system and the body in general. There may be an upper limit for exercise dosing that is optimal for health benefits, said the study's author, Peter Schnorr. If your goal is to decrease the risk of death and improve life expectancy, jogging a few times a week at a moderate pace is a good strategy. Anything more is not just unnecessary, it may be harmful. On the Talking Points page, Williams. Why did he tell false war stories? What was Brian Williams thinking? Asked David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. For several years, the NBC News anchor has been telling an ever more dramatic story about his 2003 trip to Iraq, claiming his Chinook helicopter was hit by a rocket-propelled grenade, forced to land, and rescued from the enemy by U.S. troops. But when he repeated that claim on the nightly news 2 weeks ago, several soldiers contradicted his account, prompting Stars and Stripes to report that Williams' chopper was never fired upon. Williams, we now know, has been telling tales for years, said Lloyd Grove in TheDailyBeast.com. After he covered Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, for example, Williams claimed to have contracted dysentery, witnessed a suicide in the Superdome, and seen a body float by his hotel room in an otherwise dry French Quarter. Williams apologized for the Iraq flub on the air, but this week NBC suspended him for 6 months without pay, and the $10 million a year anchor was described by a friend as remorseful and shattered. Nobody believes that Williams just made a mistake, as he claimed in his apology, said David French in NationalReview.com. It's far more likely that a titanic ego collided with reality and reality lost. Even a famous NBC News anchor feels small and insignificant next to soldiers who look death in the eye and do their job with courage and honor. Williams wanted to capture some of that reflected glory for himself. What do you expect of a guy paid to read the news off a teleprompter, said John Podhoretz in nypost.com. In the end, Williams is nothing more than a performer. That doesn't mean he's a liar, said Carl Cannon in realclearpolitics.com. Human memory is not a digital record of what actually occurred. As experts say, we all change details of the stories we tell every time we tell them. It's entirely plausible that over 12 years, Williams lost track of what actually happened. NBC bears some of the responsibility, too, said Ken Auletta in NewYorker.com. The networks market their news anchors as godlike figures and have been everywhere and seen everything. That's why the anchors are sent off to do theatrical stand-ups in war zones, hurricanes, and earthquakes. A man who feels a need to live up to that exaggerated role could easily fall into telling self-aggrandizing tales and maybe actually believing them. And another Talking Point article, To Kill a Mockingbird, an unlikely sequel. It may be one of the most monumental discoveries in contemporary American literature, said Alexandra Alter and Serge Kovaleski in the New York Times. But when HarperCollins announced last week that it will publish a long-lost sequel to Kill a Mockingbird, Harper Lee's epoch-defining novel about the Jim Crow South, it sparked a fierce debate over whether the famously reclusive 88-year-old author was pressured or manipulated into publishing it. Set about 20 years ago after the global bestseller, Go Set a Watchman was in fact written before Mockingbird, but was rejected by Lee's editor and eventually forgotten. Lee's lawyer, Tonya Carter, found the manuscript last year in an archive and says she convinced her elderly client to publish her second book, 55 years after her first. Some of Lee's close friends in Alabama contend she is mentally infirm and never would have consented to the book's publication. Is one of America's most revered authors being exploited? It's hard not to be suspicious, said Malcolm Jones in thedailybeast.com. Lee has been living in an assisted living facility, nearly blind and nearly deaf, since suffering a stroke in 2007. Her loyal older sister, Alice, who acted as her lawyer and gatekeeper until her death last year, warned in 2011 that the author would sign anything put before her. Lee surely can't be doing it for the money, said Megan Garber in TheAtlantic.com. Read by schoolchildren across the world, Mockingbird still sells a million copies a year. Moreover, Lee has repeatedly rejected the possibility of publishing a second novel, saying, "I have said what I wanted to say." Her new lawyer released a statement in which Lee insisted she was happy as hell that Watchmen was being published. But you have to wonder, why has Lee changed her mind? And why do it now? Besides, do we really want a sequel to Mockingbird? Asked Alexander Petrie in WashingtonPost.com. Sequels have their place in literature, but Mockingbird is a story on its own, full, complete. Scout Finch, its narrator, journeys from lost innocence to the edge of wisdom and maturity, learning that the world is uglier than you thought, but still better than you hoped in some ways, too. That's the Scout I want to remember. Safe, contained within the covers of a book. Better, surely, to leave her that way. And we'll finish up the hour with a couple of quotes today. Keep your eyes open to your mercies. The man who forgets to be thankful has fallen asleep in life. That's from Robert Louis Stevenson. And this from Albert Einstein. Coincidences are God's way of remaining anonymous. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.